Golf Smarter, number 406, published on October 15, 2013, is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter. And by the brand new Golf Smarter app for Apple and Android, along with the newly improved GolfSmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
10 Sensible Rules for Golfing with Others with writer Shane Ryan.
This is Golf Smarter. Sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to the Golf Smarter Podcast, Shane.
How's it going, Fred? Thanks very much for having me.
Oh, thank you for joining me. It's going very well. How are you?
I'm doing great. Wonderful morning.
What are you working on?
Well, I'm just went out and chipped and putted a little today to get my my golf in, and now the rest of the day I'll be working on some A-Rod material for Grantland.com.
Tell me, how did you get to Grantland.com? It's an awesome website for a sports fan.
Yeah, thank you. Well, yeah, Grantland is a site, an ESPN site started by Bill Simmons 2 years ago. And I'm located in the Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina area. And at the time when it started, or I guess a few months before it started, I had this blog that was called Seth Curry Saves Duke, which is a Duke basketball blog primarily. And I wrote one post. I was actually a journalism student at the same time at the University of North Carolina. And I went to the ACC tournament on a credential from the school. Came back and wrote a post for the blog, which was unaffiliated with the school, that was essentially like, here's what's wrong with sports journalism from what I saw this weekend at the ACC tournament. And I was a younger man in those days and kind of punky, and it was, you know, young and brash and everything else. And it
Aren't
was,
we all?
I guess, yeah, I guess we all were. I've certainly grown up, but you know, it was pretty iconoclastic and in your face, and it spread around, and a lot of people liked it, and of course, a lot of people didn't. But Bill Simmons was one of the people who liked it, and he emailed me. He emailed me, and that's how we started communicating. And that, I guess, that was in March of 2010. No, I'm sorry. It must be March 2011. Yeah, and so a couple months later, when Grantland was starting in the summer of 2011, I sent him a piece I had written on the NBA Finals
that he kind of right in his wheelhouse.
Yeah, and it wasn't even that great a piece or anything, but basically he and his editors talked, and they're like, okay, listen, why don't we give you a tryout, a sort of audition for the blog on Grantland.com, which is called The Triangle. Why don't you do you have 3 days, do a recap post in the morning, because that's what we're looking for. You know, use your own, do whatever you want, be creative, and then do a second post in the afternoon about, again, a topic of your choice. So wow. For 3 days I did this, and they liked it, and yeah, that's how it started. I got a job there, and since then I still do the blog mostly, but I've been able to write features and travel a little bit and do things like that. It's been pretty wonderful.
So wait, this is your job out of college?
Well, out of journalism school. So
graduate school.
Yeah, exactly. So I graduated college in 2005 from Duke University.
Okay.
And with an English degree, and was going to be a short story and fiction writer. Lived in Brooklyn, New York for 5 years, and I just had an office job because I had to support myself at a cancer center. And that was kind of, you know, the post-college years, which were not were not as lucky or romantic as what happened after I went back to journalism school. So
I put
my time in the harsh real world, I feel like, or some time anyway, maybe not that much time.
No, wait a minute. Do I need to pursue the cancer center? What?
Well, so it was this Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and I worked in the records division. So I wasn't actually in the hospital. I was not in the really sad part. But I was, you know, I was a secretary there who did almost no work. It's a typical New York job where I got paid $50,000 a year for doing nothing. You know, I mean, only in New York could that happen.
There's movies about that.
Yeah, right. But unfortunately, that may sound like a cushy gig, but it was actually sort of depressing and not fun. And
moved you off to graduate school.
Yeah, I said I got to go to graduate school and make a lot less money, and but hopefully become happier.
So then this is your first gig out of graduate school.
Right. Yeah. I actually didn't finish graduate school. So I got the gig after 1 year of a 2 year program. And so I never got my master's degree.
Oh, okay. Yep. But you got the gig. And this is your primary job? We're writing for Bill Simmons?
It is my, yeah, it's my primary job. The other thing I do a lot is I write for a magazine called Paste Magazine out of Atlanta, and that's writing about film and TV and music. But yeah, you know, those two things are how I make my money.
Not about podcasts? You don't write about podcasts?
I don't write about podcasts. I do. I've done a bunch
of
podcasts.
It's been nice
podcasts.
Talking to you. I'm done with this. I don't need you anymore.
Sure. You pay me $200. I'll write a 500-word piece about your podcast.
Yeah, thanks.
That won't be published on Grantland, though.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Just published the on my other that we blog need. That nobody ever visits.
Well, let's talk about something that you did write on Grantland that was just so much fun about golf. Tell me about your golf history, your golf life, and what brought you to writing this piece.
Okay, so my golf life, well, I'll start back when I was a kid, and my stepdad was really, really into golf. And as a kid, I played basketball, baseball, football, the, you know, quote-unquote exciting sports, and couldn't stand golf.
And
I love my stepdad, and we got along great, but he would ask me to caddy for him sometimes, and once in a while I'd do it out of guilt, and it was just the longest day. And then Sundays,
you're a kid who played all the sports, and all you got to do was carry the bag?
Well, he would try to take me to the driving range, and he would try to, you know, take me there and teach me to hit, and it was just too frustrating for me as a kid.
Right.
I would get mad, and it would end up not going well. I'll tell you, though, one time I said, like, okay, I'll go to the range with you, but what I'm going to do is bring a baseball glove, and you hit your 9 irons out there, and I'm going to go catch them. I was maybe 10 years old. 10 years old, he said, okay, that sounds...
Bring your batting helmet, son.
Yeah, that sounds fine. Well, yeah, that's, you know, you're prescient because I was out there and I took one in the head and took like 15 stitches and was bleeding like crazy. And my stepdad thought maybe he'd killed me because one of his 9 irons came crashing down on my... And I still have the scar from that. You know, you can still see that. I hated golf. I hated watching it. On Sundays, he would always have some minor PGA Tour event on, and I always wanted to watch football, and there'd be a fight. But I would eventually really enjoy watching the majors with him. That became something I really liked, and I think that was the starting point where I started to get more into golf. And then by college, I really liked watching it. I would hit sometimes, not very often. Last summer, I said, you know, I'm going to play golf. And now I'm absolutely addicted. I've been playing about a year and a half, and it's wonderful. And I watch more golf than ever. I go to tournaments to cover it for Grantland, and it's a big part of my life now. But it certainly wasn't something that I was born to or even enjoyed when I was a child.
Yeah, and my son, similarly, is loving the game now, but hated it as a youngster. Mm-hmm. And now says to me, why didn't you force me to play more? I'd be so much better now. It's like, really? Force you? Is there anything I could force you to do?
And I'm always
couldn't
amazed
even get you to
people.
Bed on time.
Yeah, I'm always amazed when I play with friends who I say, you know, when did you start? Oh, when I was 8. You know, I've played since then. Because in my mind, I'm like, when you're a kid, how can anybody tolerate golf? It's right. You know what I mean? It's your brain. In my mind, your brain is just not ready for that. But I guess some kids are, you know, more mature than I was, or better.
It's a maturity thing. Then why am I even playing? I don't even understand.
That's right.
That.
I'm still not mature. So
yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, I think. Listen, and someday you're going to probably be a dad. And here's my only advice to you: when your kid's ready to go out to the golf course, or you've decided it's time to take them, first thing, do not take them to the driving range. Take them to the putting green.
Yes.
It's free, and they can understand putting the ball in the hole. And if you can fall in love with putting the ball in the hole first, you're going to fall in love with the game. And then you'll be really good at the hardest part of the game, and that's putting.
I like that. That's a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just because little kids will get that, you know, put the ball here. Here's 2 inches. Put it in. Yay, you win. Right. And
right,
if they
get,
they can just sit next to a hole and drop balls in. If they understand that, then you get them rolling it in from 2 feet away and then 3 feet and 5 feet. And if they get into the zone on doing that and they become really good at putting when they're little, everything's going to be easy after that. Right.
Yeah, and putting is so much physically easier. You know, a little kid the littlest kid can still hit the ball rather than you know, trying to take an iron out, and that's impossible sometimes.
Well, you played all the sports as a kid. Is golf not the hardest of all the games you've ever played?
Oh, absolutely. There's just no
comparison. That's the most bizarre concept.
It is.
The ball's just sitting there, and it's the hardest game.
Any other sport, you can see some sort of immediate feedback. You could take somebody who had never played basketball before, and I bet if they had any athletic ability, by the end of the day, they could make layups, you know, like on a semi-consistent basis, or at least have the ingredients to do it. Golf is just it seems random. You certainly improve the more you play, but the peaks and valleys, and you go back and forth, and sometimes it seems like you've lost everything. You know, you could be playing for 2 years, and bam, it's all gone. It's an unbelievably cruel game, I think.
And that's why we keep coming back.
Oh, and it's so addictive. It is. It's like an abusive relationship. It's like, you know, I think a lot of us have always dated somebody, and male or female, have dated somebody who's been horrible to us, you know, for most of the time. But then there are these moments that are sort of transcendent and really good. And so we keep coming back thinking, you know, it could always be like that. Eventually, if I just stick around long enough, it's all going to be these beautiful moments. And in the end, of course, it's not true because the foundation of the relationship is abusive. And that's essentially how I feel about golf right now.
Yeah, you figured it out. You have definitely figured it out. Well, you also have a very fun piece that you wrote for Grantland on the 10 sensible rules for golfing with others. Now, the way I read this to me was your pet peeves.
That's true, but I will also put on the caveat that I have committed all 10 of these. So they are my pet peeves now, but sometimes most of them I've gotten past, some I still do, but I'm certainly not innocent of any of them. But you're right, they're the things that are pet peeves that definitely annoy me when other people do, but that I've also unfortunately done.
and when you did them, did you realize at the moment it's like, oops, or
yeah,
it was like you just kept doing it until someone called you on it?
Exactly. Most of them I realized right away or slightly afterward. I realized, wait, that was stupid. I shouldn't have done that. It's really annoying.
Well, let's get into those. But before we do that, I want to get into all the details of the article because it cracked me up. And I want to put you to task on some of them. Before we do that, I want to break for our sponsor. That is Audible. And this episode of the Golf Smarter Podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than... Now, people, the audience has heard this commercial a lot of times, and they're probably singing along with me, but right now I have to tell them that there's more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including many audio versions of New York Times bestsellers. And Audible loves having Golf Smarter listeners hear from our guests what books they would recommend as an audiobook. And so I throw it out to you because you're a writer. Do you do audiobooks?
I usually read books in print. I don't know if I've done an audiobook, but I certainly have one I can recommend that I'm just finished that's been excellent.
Really?
Yes.
And what book might that be?
That is a book called Life by Keith Richards, which is a memoir. And Richards, as most of you probably know, is the guitarist of the Rolling Stones. Mm-hmm. And, with Mick Jagger, one of the two principal songwriters. And it's just an amazing – I'm not even that huge a Rolling Stones fan, but it's just such an amazing story of an interesting life in music and a guy who just lives sort of over the edge and differently than most
sort
of us.
Sort of over the edge?
quite over the edge.
Yeah.
And that lifestyle is attractive in a way to me, even though I don't live it. It's kind of neat to read about others who have.
And survived.
Exactly. And yeah.
I think that's the big part of this story is that he survived that lifestyle.
Exactly. Exactly.
Unbelievable. Well, it is. It's Life, written by Keith Richards with James Fox. I think the audiobook would be awesome because it's narrated by Johnny Depp.
There you go. And as you guys probably know, Johnny Depp, his character in Pirates of the Caribbean is based off Keith Richards, the way he behaved and acted. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that ties that together. And it, and actually, the book is over 23 hours long, so it would be a phenomenal book to have as your first book because you can get it for free. So if you've not had an account before, all you have to do is go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter and sign up for a new account. And that first book, your first month is free. And if you're not satisfied, you don't have to hang on to it. But I'm not going to tell you that. I just want to tell you that you need to go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter. Sign up for any book you'd like. And if you want to take his recommendation, sign up for Life, written by Keith Richards. Thank you very much for that recommendation. Again, that's audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter. All right, Shane, 10 sensible rules for golfing with others.
That's right.
I'm going to just let you play with this. You want to start at the bottom or the top? Where do you want to go?
Well, let's go. We'll present it as it's presented in the article. I guess, start with number one.
Okay. Number one, keep your swearing to a reasonable level.
Right.
Define reasonable.
Well, one thing I said in the article, and then I'll back up here, is that if there is somebody who doesn't swear on the golf course, I think that person and I have a fundamental difference of perspective and behavior. And I don't know if I could ever be friends with someone who didn't swear on the golf course. Even though I can admire and respect them from a distance, I am someone who absolutely has to let it fly, because as we talked about, golf is such a frustrating and cruel game that I think sometimes in those moments of anger, you just got to get it out somehow. And swearing is just a wonderful, wonderful outlet. That being said, there's a difference between, the mild, swear word that you throw out after you hit a bad shot or something like that, versus these displays of embarrassing rage that sometimes come over people where they're, getting red in the face and they go on these tirades and they just seem totally out of control. And so when I say keep your swearing to a reasonable level, what I mean is don't be the person who embarrasses yourself with these sort of out of control hyper rants.
And if it's not a regular foursome or you've been matched up or something and this is a friend of yours, you don't want to do that to your friend either.
Both are bad. I mean, doing it in front of strangers certainly is just like that makes them entirely uncomfortable. But when you do it with your friend, it's not much better, because what can the friend do except stand there and go, not say anything? I mean, it's
I'll tell you, I've got a buddy who I play golf with who's a clergy. Right. And whenever we play with people, and he's from New York originally. So, All right. And when we play with people that he doesn't know and he messes up a shot, I swear to you, he says, "Jeepers, creepers." I've heard him do it. But when we're alone, he doesn't use those words.
He's very good
at controlling himself and knowing his place. But It's so funny to hear him go off on it. It's like, hey, you're clergy. You can't do that. Well, number one then kind of leads you into number two, doesn't it? Never throw or slam your club in anger.
Yeah, and again, we talk about things that I do as I say and not as I do. Here's one that I have done twice.
Ooh.
At least two times that are prominent in my memory for reasons that you'll soon see. Once I was taking a 4-iron off the tee. This was last summer, and was so frustrated at how the round was going that I just threw this club. I tried to throw it straight down the fairway as hard as I could. But I guess maybe because I was hooking all my other shots, I also hooked my throw and held on too long. And it went sailing to the left into these thick woods. And I sat there for about 45 minutes with my friend trying to find this club and could not do it. I don't know if it stood up in a tree or what. It was unbelievable. It felt like, being taught a lesson from on high. And all these, all the other golfers were coming through, and we had to keep telling them, go through. And it was pretty obvious what had happened, that I had thrown my club and was trying to find it.
Your friend must have been so mad at you.
He was annoyed. He was very annoyed at me. Yeah. I never found the club, and
you had to go out and buy a new one.
Yeah.
Or did you buy a hybrid?
You know what happened? This is horrible, because it's like no punishment, but that was around Thanksgiving last year. And a month later for Christmas, my parents bought me new clubs. And so I wasn't even punished that much. Like these were clubs that I bought for $150 off a friend. And, my first set of real clubs were coming a month later, which I didn't know. So it's, not too much of a huge consequence, but at the same time, it was very embarrassing.
Oh, yeah. Now, you said there were two stories that you had.
Yeah, and the other one was from last weekend. I had not thrown a club. Or 2 weekends ago, I guess. I had not thrown a club since then.
Wait, after you wrote this article?
No, before.
So okay.
Whatever the weekend was before this article. So this was published on August 1st. So I guess it was the last weekend in July. This was, again, I hadn't thrown a club since, because I thought I'd learned my lesson. Then I was on the driving range, And it was one of those situations where I went early in the morning and I wanted to practice my three wood because I was playing around and my three wood is just terrible off the tee. And so I went, and unfortunately the sun was rising right beyond the driving range. And so I could not get any feedback. I was hitting my three wood, could not see where the ball went. And it was very frustrating because essentially, as you know, there's no way to practice because you have to see the results mm-hmm. in order to know what works or how to adjust or anything like that. So I couldn't see the ball, so my three wood, no good. So anyway, so I moved on to the irons, already very angry and kind of like, oh, this round is going to be a disaster because I couldn't practice. I'm going to be terrible, et cetera, et cetera. And I started hitting eight irons, and again, I couldn't see them, and I was making terrible contact, and I lost it. I took the handle of the club and threw the club into the ground, sort of like so the head hit first, and the club just snapped right in half.
Ouch.
Yeah. And that was the first time I'd thrown a club since the time before, and it broke. So I get punished every time I throw my club, and this time I didn't have a new set of clubs coming, so I had to pay $50 or whatever to get it fixed.
Oh, bad yeah. boy. No, you don't. You don't throw. Was it a grass driving range, or was it you hitting off of mats?
No, it was grass. It was okay. grass.
So you threw it like it was like you were playing with a knife, right? A pocket
knife?
Yeah,
you throw a knife down and you just sort of like
and it snapped.
End over end into the ground. It's too much. Too much for my poor 8-iron.
So do you generally hit your irons better or you were struggling? You said you struggle with your 3-wood off the tee. Are you better with your woods or your irons? Or
you know, the thing is, I started golf, and when I started, I took a very kind of measured approach where I do a lot of chipping and putting and a lot of irons. I hit my irons all the time.
Smart.
And honestly, for a year, I don't think I really hit many woods off the tee, period. And so I practiced more this summer, but still not very much. So, yeah, my irons are way better just because I think for the simple reason of I don't really understand how to hit woods yet. Now, I hit the ball. I can sometimes hit a 3-wood really, really well. I don't even touch my driver yet because it's just not even worth it. But for the next stage of my golf life, essentially, is going to be all about woods because I haven't really got there yet.
Mm. You know, it's so interesting. The nuances of all this stuff with golf just blows my mind on how much I'm learning from the podcast when we talk to instructors. And just recently, this guy, Ken Doherty, was the director of instruction over at the Marin Country Club near me. Mm-hmm. And he talked about, and just like it was epiphany for me when he was talking about how the swing for your irons is a more descending blow and your swing for your woods is a more sweeping stroke, right?
Right?
And it's like,
right.
Oh, you mean there are different swings for each club? I'm not trying to do. Oh, it's like, really, Fred, you've been doing this for 8 years and that's the first time you've heard that?
And when I hear that, it's so intimidating to me because I'm like, I'm not good enough to have two swings. I can only do one. I can only do one thing, you know?
Yeah.
And it's tough. It's just, so I swing my woods just like my irons and sometimes it works, but you know, it's a pretty iffy proposition at this point.
So when you are covering golf tournaments, you're there.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have the advantage of, I think golf on television is as good as football on television. I mean, those two sports need to be on TV.
Yeah, sure.
Because it's hard to, I mean, like when you're there, unless you're sitting in the press tent, how do you cover everything that's going on, right?
Well, yeah, what you do is, I love being live at golf. So, I mean, I totally agree with you that if you're going to be a spectator, it's great to have it on television. They do such a wonderful job. But there are things you can pick up when you're there and when you're writing your story that are incredibly personal, and it can capture the spirit of golf better than TV can, because the way TV works, you see a shot and then you cut to the next shot and then you cut to the next shot, and it's nonstop action and it's very exciting. But the truth about golf, as anybody who plays it knows, is that it's a game where the actual action that you have, the physical action that you have throughout a round, may total to 1 minute in 18 holes, and it's just your swings. You know, it may be less than a minute. And what most of golf is walking along and dealing with the mental thing and planning and strategizing and trying to control your reactions. And then, you know, maybe you're intimidated by the other guy, or you're trying to intimidate, or you're trying to keep your cool. It's just such a nuanced mental game that when you're actually with the players, you know, you can see what's happening with them. You can see how the gallery is reacting. You can see what they're doing. And you can illustrate that in writing, I think, better than you ever could if you were sitting in the press tent or watching from your couch at home.
Beautifully put. I never really considered that you getting the essence of the game while being there watching. But then you're not there as a fan. You're there as a journalist. So you're there to more than just mark down the guy's score or see how far he hit the ball. You're trying to capture the entire event all at one time.
Yeah, and especially for the kind of writing I do. So there are a lot of people, you know, who are with the AP or whatever who are writing articles that say, well, Tiger Woods leads the tournament at -5 today. He made, you know, birdies on this hole and this hole,
right,
and he hit this shot and
reporting
and the other people.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm writing more of a narrative kind of nonfiction style, and I require those details to make it interesting. And to kind of answer the question that I think you were going at before, you are obliged to be on your toes and to try to pick the group that you think is going to yield the winner or yield at least an excellent story. And so a good example is at the PGA this last weekend, I had this instinct that Henrik Stenson was going to light it up in the final round. And
what
he was
gave
going
you that idea?
You know, I just thought he's been playing such great golf. I thought Jim Furyk was going to choke like he always does, and I wasn't sure about Duffner because he hadn't been putting well. Mm-hmm. And so I was looking at it, and I was like, who is the guy that's going to do it? Everybody thought, oh, maybe Rory will make a big charge in the last end. But I thought, you know,
well, he did the end of Saturday. He made a big charge, right?
Right, yeah. And so he was at -3, 6 shots off the lead, and he was a very attractive and trendy pick for people. Where I was thinking, you know, it's just he's too far away. I mean, I know Mickelson just did it at the British, but it just doesn't feel right. So anyway, yeah, my idea was that Stenson was going to do it because he's a really funny guy. It would have been a great story. So there's probably also that bias in me because 2 years ago he was playing in his club championship. You know, he was having such a slump. So anyway, I said, I'm going to follow Stenson around. That's going to be what I do. But at a certain point, I have to realize that I've got to hightail it back to the leaders if Stenson's not doing anything. And for me, that was on the 7th hole. I said, Stenson, it's not happening with Stenson. And oh, look at this. Duffner's nailing every iron he hits. So I better go back here and get with Furyk and Duffner. And so I did that at about the 7th hole and then and went with them the rest of the way, and it worked out. But you have to, you know, like where to be. Otherwise, like you said, you pick the wrong group and all of a sudden you've got a story about Henrik Stenson that nobody's going to want to read because Duffner just won the PGA Championship.
Is it pressure for you to be out there hunting for a story, knowing that you've got to do more than just report that Duffner's playing well? I mean, you've got to be, you know, looking in all directions at all times with your nose up in the air, looking for something, someone that is going to make this opportunity for you unique.
You know, I love it. I think that's the most exciting part. It's there's the good kind of pressure. You know, it feels like if you're a journalist, that's the closest, that's your quote unquote war. That's you going off to war because you're essentially being a detective. You're taking your analytical abilities and your ability to find a story and your instincts or whatever, and you're putting them to the test in this very short time period where, you know, the stakes of failure are pretty high because you have to find that story within a set number of hours. And I just think it's really fun. I think it's my favorite part of the job when you're doing that. So yes, there is pressure, but I certainly it's not a bad kind of pressure.
Well, the upsides are finding the story. The downside is obviously not coming up with a story, or coming up with a story that when you submit it, they go, "Really? This is all you got?"
Right.
Has that happened to you?
You know, I don't think too often because I think there is always. So the first part is hunting for the story, like I said, and the second part is writing, which is itself a kind of hunt because, you know, sometimes there can be a boring result or there can be this or that, and you have to find the angle that works in combination with whatever you found while you were on the scene. So there's – I don't know. You know, I mean, I don't think I've ever handed in a story where I said to myself, well, this is terrible and I found nothing and I'm just, you know, BSing. Within the writing, I don't think I've ever had that. I think there's always been, and again, knock on wood, hopefully this continues, but there's always been something that excited me or that I found created a great angle for a story.
I know as a content creator, especially when I'm producing video content and I'm out shooting and getting as much as I can, not just the main subject, but what you have is called B-roll, which is, you know, the video that fills in all the blanks and allows you to cut back and forth to different things. And no matter how much you shoot, when you come back and you're starting to do your post-production, there's a moment where you go, I don't have enough shots. I don't have enough content.
Sure, sure.
Does that happen for your writing too, that you're like, oh, why didn't I ask him this question? Why didn't I?
Well, I'll tell you, there are certainly times, especially after I've done an interview, where I'll be listening and transcribing to the interview, and I'm going, Shane, like, were you not listening? The opportunity for this brilliant follow-up was right there. You know, like he said something that led to this follow-up that you need to have, and it would have been a great question. And instead, like a robot, you went on down your list and asked the next question, totally changing topic. Like, you missed a great opportunity there. So yeah, that definitely happens, and that's instructive, and that helps you get better. But in terms, you know, I'm the kind of writer who, if you were my boss and you said, Shane, we need 1,500 words on this story, I would write it and it would be 2,500 words, and I'd go, oh crap, I have to cut 1,000, and then I'd go to you going, hey, can I have 2,000? And you'd go, oh, you know, 1,800 or whatever, and I'd be like, oh, I'll try. You know, I'm not someone who, when you assign me 1,500, I'm gonna have 1,000 and then go, oh crap, I need 500 more words. That's just, you know, the words I've got, I'm a big mouth, you know, and I always have been.
Help, I'm talking and I can't shut up.
Exactly. And with writing, it's that way. And I always think it's interesting. And it's like, you know, it always goes over. So that's always been my issue. So a lack of content has not been my my problem.
Awesome. Right, well, you know what? Look, we've only got as classic with a conversation that I generate here. We've only gotten to two of these, okay. And we've got seven more to go, or eight more to go. Can you stick around so we can record and discuss these at length? Because I'm obviously having fun being distracted by other things, and we can do a members only episode?
Sure.
Okay. So for those of you who are not members, if you'd like to hear the other seven parts of this conversation with Shane, please join Golf Smarter for members only today at golfsmarter.com. And then you can also have access to all these interviews. There are part two that you never get a chance to hear and really have all the juicy stuff in it. So please join Golf Smarter for members only today. But before we go, for this audience, Shane, I want to let them know how to read what you are doing and subscribe to your readings to find you at grantland.com, I guess.
Yeah, grantland.com, Pace Magazine, and I'm on Twitter at Shane Ryan here. And yeah, that's those are the primary places to find my bombastic, big mouth writings. Now, yeah. So that's where you can check me out.
Awesome. All right. Well, buddy, thank you so much for your time here and for sticking around, and look forward to part two.
Yeah, okay, time to get the money people on. This is where we get the really good stuff, folks. You're not going to believe the great stuff we have in the paid version.
Actually, we do have a lot of fun on that second episode. Well, here we are in mid-October, and the oncoming of fall means we're having our annual transition from summer to winter sports, shorter hours of sunlight, and more time to think about golf than actually playing. So what's a golfer to do? I got an idea. How about we join the Golf Smarter listeners in Australia for some spring golf? Yeah! No, that's not going to happen. good tease, ain't going to happen. So what can we do about it? Practice. Practice and practice. And if you cannot get out to a driving range or even a decent practice putting green because you're stuck indoors until March, you know, I highly advise getting a putting mat with the ball return. Actually, I've had a couple, and my favorite is the Accelerator Pro Ball Return Putting Mat by Skillz, S-K-L-Z. I have one here in my office. And what I love most about this putting mat is the lines are painted on the mat, and they allow you to watch the ball come off the putter face and see if you indeed are putting the ball straight over 3, 5, and 7-foot putts. It definitely keeps my putting tuned when my work schedule doesn't allow a lot of time for me to play. But mostly, it gives me a lot more confidence when I'm out on the course. It's amazing if I, you know, put 10, 15 minutes, if I put 3 minutes, I can't do anything for 10, 15. If I put time into putting, practice my putting on a regular basis on this mat, it definitely shows up on the course. And if you're interested in picking one up for yourself, the best price that I found and where I bought it for myself is through Amazon. And I'm going to make it available in our Golfers Mart through Amazon. And if you subscribe to Amazon Prime, you'll get free shipping. Here's how you get it, though. once you install the new Golf Smarter app for Apple or for Android mobile devices, you'll be able to simply make the purchase right from your phone or tablet. The new Golf Smarter app is free, and once you have it installed, you'll also have the last five episodes of Golf Smarter ready to go. No more iTunes. No more syncing. It's all right there, including all our videos. And it's free at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.